Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists and experts from around the world. I'm Viv Davis, it's the 20th of January 2014, and today's interview is with Alejandro Jara, former Deputy Director General at the WTO and currently Senior Counsel at King & Spalding. We discussed the 2013 WTO Ministerial Conference and the recent Vox report that Jara co-edited with Simon Evenet, Building on Bali. I began the interview by asking Alejandro whether he considered the Bali Conference to have been a success.
Well, let me start with a negative. I believe Bali was a success because it was not a failure. And when the expectations were so low, particularly in the days just before Bali, when many aspects of the negotiations were hijacked by different countries, etc., it became very difficult to envisage a positive result. But somehow, at the end, it was pragmatism that won the day, and certain flexibility, and I would say it's an exercise of good political responsibility. Secondly, I believe that after several years, this exercise showed that it is actually possible that agreements be crafted in the WTO, meaningful agreements such as the one on trade facilitation. So I think that's terribly important because of the demonstration effect it has in the public opinion. And third, because of that, the fact that it provides, I'd say, a good momentum and along with it, political support to embark on a post-Bali agenda, including DDA conclusion.
What are the main features of the post-Bali agenda that is of interest for the major world traders, for example?
First of all, the agenda for the post-Bali era has not yet been defined. WTO is not only about the Doha negotiations. There is a lot of regular work going on, and thus priorities and resources have to be defined with regards to that. In addition, there is a looming agenda of things, some of which are already discussed in the WTO, some of which still have to be discussed in order to address concerns of today's world. So, in essence, the WTO has to embark in a process of enhancing its analytical capacity and to exchange views about possible international cooperation in many different fields, besides attempting to conclude the DDA. One thing, I believe, goes with the other. As somebody, Richard Baldwin, suggested in the book, perhaps the DDA, it's not self-balancing. We have to go out and at least start doing things with the implicit promise that they're further down the road, there will be more international cooperation and more an update of the rule book in order to adapt the WTO to the present realities and future challenges. But in order to do that, very clearly, the DDA has to be concluded. Now, what here is of more interest to the major trading partners? I would say that for the major, the smaller trading partners, etc., it's essential that we do more international cooperation in all areas, and that requires balance and it requires flexibility. And let me answer also the next point, what would be of the benefit to the smaller, poorer members. And here I would say without this, they stand to lose more. And they need better markets and they need better rules all around. And thus, they have more of a vested interest and a stake in securing a better multilateral trading system.
So these mega regional trading agreements under negotiation, such as TTP, TTIP, this puts the governance of global trade significantly away from the WTO. Can the WTO survive that?
There are several ways to look at this phenomenon, and it's been going on now for some time in terms that we have an increasing spiral of negotiation of free trade agreements involving more and bigger markets. I would say that partly this is due to the fact that governments are struggling against discrimination. In other words, typically when the EU saw that the United States was beginning a negotiation of a free trade agreement with Korea, they suspended the moratorium that had been in place for the negotiations of a new free trade agreements and enticed and persuaded Korea to begin a negotiation of the road because they could not afford to lose that market. It is true that there is a shift away from the WTO with these negotiations, a shift mainly that it takes away, it draws on the political energy and the resource from the multilateral trading setting. Now, will it affect the governance of global trade? Yes and no, but to say anything about that, one has to first look at the end result, whether it's the animal TPP or TPIP going to look like. I believe all these agreements are truly part of a system, a multilateral and international trading system. And there is few resources, too little, I must say, in order to ensure that there is coherence. First of all, these agreements liberalize trade, and I think that however that is done, it's a good thing. It's better, more efficient to do it multilaterally, as we all know. But the main risk here is about the rulemaking. If these agreements will devise new rules and disciplines, the question is to be answered at the end of the day is whether these rules will be coherent. Will they allow for convergence into the multilateral, into the WTO system at the end of the day? And that's a big risk because there's very little control over such outcomes in terms of ensuring such coherence. So the jury is still up there. I think that it's steps in the right direction. They will eventually maybe facilitate multilateral trade negotiations, but there is a huge risk involved, as I said, in terms of coherence of multilateral.
How do you see this apparent rise in murky implemented by governments around the world, as reported by Global Trade Alert, for example? How does that square with government's supposed commitment towards liberalization?
Well, for one thing, I would look first at the non-murky protectionism, which, of course, is contained and disciplined by rules, be it multilateral or bilateral, etc. So we've seen a little bit of that, but it's not as much as in the past. That must mean that the rules, the disciplines, the international obligations do have some effect in terms of controlling and resisting suppression. So this leads me to say, with regards to murky protectionism, that perhaps we've seen more and more of it, precisely because either the rules are not all that precise, are not all that efficient, or because there are no rules. For example, for many countries or in several sectors, it's perfectly fine to discriminate by using government procurement, because there are no obligations in certain sectors or for certain agencies, etc. So, where such is the case, I believe that governments have few instruments to resist pressures for more protection, because such forms of protection become illegal, or at least in principle, the instruments they're using are perfectly fine within the multilateral trading system. So what this means is that what we have seen, I believe, is murky protectionism demonstrates that governments have generally been weak in terms of containing protectionist pressures through apparently legal means, and thus there's a failure of institutions at the domestic level, and it shows the weaknesses of some of the multilateral rules in this respect.
To what extent, Alejandro, do you think that the so-called global value chain revolution has changed the nature and focus of international trade and trade agreements?
I believe that this revolution it's beginning to change. It's far from over. I think we have to devise new and better ways to look at the world, and the data and the way we capture and collect our numbers still leaves much to be desired. Big efforts have been made by the WTO, the OECD, and other agencies in this respect. What the evidence comes out very clearly is that it makes, for many, the distinction between us and them, between the domestic and the foreign good or supplier, more and more of a nonsense. It just doesn't make sense to look at the world like that, and it leads to bad policies and wrong outcomes. And the other thing which I believe is also very telling is that what the studies and evidence is beginning to tell us is that separation between trade in goods, trade in services, and in investment is very artificial, and that there is less and less a case to treat this as separate things within each one with its own compartment and set of rules. Business doesn't operate like that, and thus the reality of today's world require that we have a more of a holistic approach, and as a consequence, I believe we have to begin to adapt the rules and the political process of trade negotiations accordingly in order to capture this phenomenon. Having said that, I have to point out that while this revolution is a fact, and it's an evolving one, there are big chunks of economies there out there in the world that are more or less largely absent from this revolution. For example, most of Latin America, with the exception of Mexico and Costa Rica, Middle East, Africa, and other parts of the world, are not in the global value chain yet. And we have to ask why, and to see what if the policies that these countries or some of these countries are adopting are conducive or not in order to seek a better integration into the global change.
Finally, Alejandro, if you could briefly summarize, say, your three major recommendations would be to policymakers for optimizing the world trading system, what would they be?
First and foremost, first recommendation is start to conclude the Doha Development Agenda. It's going to be a long process because many things have to change. And perhaps be ambitious and not be shy. And by this, I mean, perhaps you can do more by being more ambitious and take longer to implement results. If one looks at around the world how things are shaping up because of free trade agreements up and down and left and right, it would not be too far-fetched to think that, let's say, in the time horizon of 20, 30 years, to have a duty-free world. And take that negotiation over 30 years. Decide now, the political impact is much less, and you put it to rest once and for all, customs duties and things like that. So these are the two factors I think members could play around with to conclude the DDA, not only in tariffs, but in some other respects as well. Secondly, as I said before, and Richard Baldwin says it in his piece in the book, I said maybe the DDA is not sufficient to bring about a balance of interest in today's world and to elicit the interest and the support of business. So I think what we need also as an outcome of the DDA, and that has to be worked before, is an agenda for a negotiation that could begin the very next day or upon entry into force of the Doha Development Agenda results to address new issues, investment, competition policy, to look at outstanding problems, export duties and restrictions, to name a few of a long list. But we have to start doing that now. And we have to, in order to do that, enhance also the analytical capacity so that every country, that every government goes into this exchange of views with an idea, a more precise idea of the impacts of these possible agendas of the future, and thus not be so defensive in having to decide upon a new future agenda for WTO. My third recommendation has to do largely with transparency. I think what we have as a system of transparency is good, but it's poor based on notification by members. There's much more what the Secretary of the WTO and others are doing, and there's much more which they could do in order to provide information and organize it so that countries, governments, stakeholders are aware of what is taking place and the dimensions of the measures. For example, brings to mind local content requirements measured around the world have undoubtedly increased, but we don't have, let's say, a database on them. We don't have information about the dimension, and therefore we have little capacity to see the impact. And part of this, too, has to do with domestic efforts. Maybe this should become an international obligation. I think that at the national level, countries need to have always some mechanism, institution, independent of government, to assess the cost of measures, preferably this assessment to be done before a measure is applied, but at least the people who will eventually have to pay are aware of how much measures on trade and investment will cost them, and therefore they can react politically and to such attempts to allocate resources in an economy by favoring some sectors and not others. I think that is also a question of public policies. To do that, I think we need a concerted effort to have these national efforts made, which will allow governments to resist protectionism, to resist discrimination all around. Those will be my few items.
Well, great food for thought and hopefully action. Alejandro Ayala, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much, Viv, and a great pleasure.